Accession number 19938, Reel 1.
Mr. Roland, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Leuven, that is Belgium, and I was born the 19th of September in 1935.
What is your mother tongue?
My mother tongue is Flemish and French. Surprisingly enough, at home we spoke French, but my education was in Flemish. And being bilingual in Belgium, I suppose, is a norm.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Leuven?
Yes, I did, until I was 16, and then I joined the Belgian Air Force.
Have you any Second World War memories?
Yes, I do. I was young. I was only 5 years old when the war started. And we lived in Leuven, or just on the outskirts of Leuven, where there is a big railway depot where they repaired machinery and they constructed locomotives. And my grandfather worked there, and we just lived just behind that depot. I remember vaguely that when the war started, I was 5 years old, leaving with my grandfather, my mother and my sister, with the intention of going to France. But we never went that far. We stayed a couple of nights with a cousin of my mother, I think, in Brussels. And then, since the German had already occupied that part of Belgium, we came back home. And we stayed there until after the war. During the war, of course, we very often, this depot was bombed, first of all by the Allied planes, trying to disrupt the communication, the German communication, the German supply lines, and very often we would spend part of the night hiding behind walls and in cellars. And even at the very end of the war, when there was a danger that the big destruction of Leuven happened, because Leuven was very, very badly damaged by the Allied bombardments, we left where we were living with my grandparents, my mother, my sister and myself, and we left to go on the other side of Leuven, where we stayed in a very little house, as far as I can remember, and unfortunately most of the nights we would spend behind the walls of the abbey, who was not very far from our house, and we were laying there shivering with blankets and during the night. But that's about all the memory I have from the war, except one specific thing is that must have been 8-9 years old, and just outside the depot I was talking about, I saw a German collaborator. Well, he was Belgian, but he was a collaborator for the Germans, being shot down by resistance fighters, and I saw it. And when I ran back to my mother and told her about it, she told me to shut up, just in case, you know, the Germans would come and ask questions about it. So I saw that happen. Then, of course, after the war, when the Germans were defeated and the Allies came in, I can quite well remember the first big lorries coming through with all these troops on the back and with helmets and rifles and giving us sweets, and And I was 10 years old when I first tasted my first orange, given to me by an American, and they gave us chewing gum and chocolate, and then behind our house we had an anti-aircraft gun that was parked with Americans, and of course they were very much in success, and they were very much, we children always were hanging around there, and they were always giving us things, and that's about all I remember from the war, except of course what we did not have. The schools very often closed, the classes moved from one area to another because there was danger. The primary school where I went moved at one time for a whole year to the other end of the village, and that was quite a bit of a disruption. But besides that, it was a normal, I suppose, if you could call it that, a normal childhood with playing around with friends. And unfortunately, we also had to go whenever the harvest was. We had to go in the fields with our parents to try to glean some potatoes or some grain that was left behind by the farmers. That was, of course, strictly forbidden by the Germans, but we did it anyway. And very often we played along the railway tracks and trying to steal some coal from the locomotives. And very often we had the conductors chucking coals at us, because there were Belgians as well, and if there was no German guard with them, you know, they would, you know, throw some these coal briquettes to us, and we would come home quite happy, you know, because we would have a bit of coal to warm us. And the famous tin tub could then on Saturday be used, you know, near a warm fire.
The bathtub.
The bathtub, yes, of course. You know, every Saturday, you know, the bathtub every Saturday. I started with the youngest and finishing with the eldest. So I was always the first one in bath, which was not very, very nice, because either the water was too cold or too warm or something like that. And it's only later, after a couple of people had been in there, that the temperature was regulated. But that's about all my memories from the Second World War. Another thing that I remember, that we were hiding a young man that was trying to avoid being sent to Germany to work, and he was living with us. We were hiding him in our attic. And of course he would only come out to eat at night. We would sneak up some food up to him, whatever food there was, and he later became a police officer. But yes, we were hiding him for 3 or 4 years, I think, you know, when they rounded up all the young people as a workforce for Germany.
When you saw the resistance executing that man, can you describe the scene that you saw?
Yes, it was about 5 o'clock when everybody came out of the factory, of the depot, and there was a double gate, metal gate, that opened up, and the workforce would come out. And I remember having been playing ball in the alley where our house was, and I saw a motorcyclist, which was very rare to have a private vehicle, a motorcyclist parked just before the exit of our alley. And then suddenly I saw the backseat passenger taking something out of his jacket, and I heard a bang, and I saw him shooting one person that came out of the depot. Most of the workforce had already been gone, and he was alone coming out. It only later on turned out that he was a collaborator, but that's all. Then, of course, as soon as he was shot down, the motorcycle left, turned immediately right in a side street and disappeared, and that was all I can remember.
Did you know any of the people involved?
No, absolutely not. No. I was too young. I don't know. There were probably people from a resistance thing that was hiding in the woods and in the mountains, and not very far from Leuven. So I don't really know anybody. No.
Which year do you think that was?
That was in 1944. Yes, 1944. Yes, 1944 it was.
Any celebrations in Leuven at the end of the war?
Well, surprisingly enough, I was not in Leuven at the end of the war. I had been sent to my grandmother. My godmother, and my godmother lived in Charleroi, which is in the French-speaking part of Belgium, and that is where I can remember. Suddenly, I was playing football outside. I was all on my own. I was playing football in the street in front of the house, and suddenly I heard all these bells ringing from everywhere, from the church towers and everybody, and the sirens going off, and I was very surprised. So I walked in and I said to my godmother, "What's happening?" She says, "The war is over. The war is over. We are free. We're free." And yes, obviously that night we had a few celebrations. I was young, of course, and I was sent to bed early, but I'm sure that the adults carried on long after that.
Now, can you tell me about joining the armed forces, please?
Well, when I've always wanted to be in uniform for one or the other reason. My stepfather served with the Belgian Air Force here in England. He was part of the British Air Force, but with a Belgian group. I don't know exactly how it worked. I think he belonged to the 365th Air Group or something like that. And when I told him that I wanted to join the forces, he was very pleased, of course, and it was through him that I got in as quickly as I was in, because I applied to join the forces when I was 16, and I joined 3 months later. So through my stepfather, I joined the Belgian Air Force. I went to a technical school where I was taught about communications and radios and Morse code and things like that. And then I worked for a year or so. No, sorry. Then I got the bug. I was just old enough and I applied to go to Korea. That was without the knowledge of my parents. But being 16, being in the forces, I didn't need the permission of my parents. I only needed the permission of my unit commander. And at that time, volunteers for Korea were much in demand, and I was authorized then to join the Belgium United Nations Command, which was the correct name for the battalion. And I was sent to Marche-les-Dames, which is also in the French-speaking part of Belgium, along the river Meuse. And there I did my 6 weeks commando training, And when I arrived, I was assigned two godfathers. Being young, 16, they didn't think that, well, they thought that it would be a good idea if I had somebody guiding me along the path of this training. And I was assigned two Belgian paratrooper volunteers. One was called Smit, and the other one was called, sorry, I forgot his name. Anyway, they kept me under their wing, and we passed the tests, paracommando tests, and I was issued the brown beret, who was the mark of the battalion. It was a special beret. It had an insignia on, and that is also special because you have on the insignia you have the Belgian lion surrounded by the mace, which is which represent the Flemish part of the battalion, the battalion, a mace, and also a poleaxe, which is the French representation of the unit. And on top of the lion, we would have a helmet for the crusade that we were going to go into by going against communism in Korea. Then when we were all kitted out, unfortunately in Belgian uniforms, which is the more than famous battle dress, the khaki battle dress with the big coat, heavy coat, we were sent to Korea and we went by plane. The Belgian government had hired three planes from Sabena, which is the Belgian airline, and they used those planes to ferry the troops back and forth to Korea. All in all, we have had in Korea 3,500 troops, Belgian troops. 100 or so of them were Luxembourgers, because they weren't big enough to have, so they were integrated into the Belgian army or into the Belgian battalion. So we had 100 or so Luxembourg soldiers within the battalion. We lost, all in all, we lost about 100 men, and we had about 350 injured during the whole of the operation. So when we arrived in Japan, we knew a lot about our battalion, because our battalion was famous. It was in the paper all the time. Everybody wrote about them. Everybody read about them. Their heroism, quote unquote, their whatever happened was in the papers. So everybody was fired up. And when we arrived in Japan, they told us to take our Belgian uniforms off, and we were issued American equipment, and that was a good thing because it was rather cold over there. When I arrived in Korea with a reinforcement of about 60 odd soldiers, there was about 60, 64, 65 of us, reinforcements. I arrived and I was assigned to the Company C. Company C was, we had three companies and a heavy weapon company in during the war there. And I was assigned to Company C. When I arrived, we arrived just after the battalion moved to the White Horse, which was a hill called the White Horse. And I had to stay one night there in a makeshift tent, of which I had half, but there was nobody else with me. So I slept, in fact, in half a tent for one night, in, luckily enough for me, in a very warm American sleeping bag with snow boots on and all very sophisticated and very good equipment. And the following day, we left the White Horse towards the what they called the Iron Triangle. The Iron Triangle was in the area of the towns of Chorwon, Kumwa, and Pyongan, not Pyongyang, who was the capital of North Vietnam, because that was 200 kilometers north of there, so it was Pyongyang. At the foot of the official name is the Osongsang Hill, but we call them the Papasan. It was easier to pronounce. It was near Shat Kol. And there we spent the rest, can I say, or almost the rest of my war in Korea. It was a position war, meaning we didn't go forward nor backward. We just had to dig ourselves in there and trying to maintain the Chinese invasion. We relieved, when we arrived there, we relieved a Turkish battalion. Turkish battalion was renowned for their fighting spirit, and most of the fighting they did was with bare hand or bayonets, and they were not interested in trenches or bunkers or things like that. So when we arrived, we had to start digging the trenches a bit deeper. We had to start digging for foxholes, which was holes dug into the side of the mountain, and you covered it with a bit of cloth or whatever you could find as a door. And also bunkers, prefabricated American bunkers that were sent down there. We were building these up. And we were positioned behind the 65th U.S. Regiment, and that was a Puerto Rican regiment. Unfortunately, they were very much demoralized because the November before that, the November of the previous year, they had been, all of them, or most of them, had been court-martialed for refusal to obey orders in the face of the enemy. And a lot of them were still waiting to appear before the court-martial. So that was rather a tricky situation there, because we couldn't really rely on these people for protection on our flank. So we spent quite a bit of time there, and my 55 nights at Shat Kol, that was from the 26th February until a month later, 21st of April, we were kept very busy fighting off Chinese infiltrations. We were trying to disrupt their patrols. We were manning listening posts. They were placed about a kilometer or so, even a bit more, before our lines. And there we would lay two or three people together with a machine gun and a rifle and a bit of grenades, and trying to let the battalion know if the Chinese were coming, when they were coming, which way they were coming. And so we spent quite a few nights in the bitter cold winter of Korea. We even had the Chinese reaching our trenches. They for one or the other reason, they must have sneaked through our barbed wire fence. These fences were alarmed with the sea ration tins hanging, dangling down there, and as soon as you touch the wires, you know, they would be making a noise. But very often it was only rats that we could see. But once they managed to get over the barbed wire and they were in the trenches, and we had to fight them off with the bayonet. During that period, we lost 20 men. There was 20 people died during that period from end April. We lost 100 men.
Which year was this?
That's 1953. 1953, that was just before the ceasefire being in, if I'm not mistaken, July or something like that. Whilst we were there, I remember that we had I was taken off the front line and was sent to become a 81 millimeter, what's it called? Gunner, mortar. And so I was trained there, and then we were just behind the three companies. And I remember our captain went up with an American light observer plane, and he was shot down. Our captain's name was Pierre Gailly. Pierre Gailly, and his brother was the commander of the A Company, and his name was Etienne Gailly. And I don't know if you know, but he was a famous marathon runner. He even ran the London Marathon during the Olympics. Not the London Marathon. He ran a marathon here in London during the Olympics. Must have been between 45 and 52, I suppose. I don't know if there was an Olympics here.
1948.
Well, he reached almost the finishing line first, and then he collapsed and he didn't never finish the race. That was one of the things I knew about him. So he was shot down, and his brother tried to go and rescue him, but they were never able to reach him, and the consensus was that the pilot and the observer, our captain, were dead when they hit the ground. What happened then? That is one of the things I remember. Oh, yes, and then afterwards, I was chosen to become the battalion commander's radio operator. And I was sent to the battalion area, to the command area, and I was promoted corporal. I was promoted corporal in Korea, and from the 22nd of April until the 15th of May, we were not on the front line, we were on the second front line, and as I said, I became the personal radio operator for the battalion commander, which means I traveled quite a bit all over the front line. And then when the ceasefire arrived on the 27th of July in 1953. We stayed there a bit longer, trying to organize our life as well as we could. And I returned.